Hi, I'm Joshua Fletcher, also known as Anxiety Josh, and I'm a qualified therapist and previous sufferer of crippling anxiety. Thank you for tuning in. The Panic Pod is part of the School of Anxiety, which is my project to help as many people as I can with the condition. The School of Anxiety includes this podcast, my self-help books, do-it-at-home courses, and my popular weekly newsletter. If you'd like to get this free newsletter every week directly from me, then sign up in 30 seconds at schoolofanxiety.com or in my bio on social media. There you'll hear success stories, did it anyways, psychoeducation, my tip of the week, and an introduction to this week's podcast guest, if there is one. I hope you enjoy the episode, and remember, you are not broken. Welcome to the Panic Pod. I think we're on season four now. Welcome back. We've got a brilliant season in store for you. The title of today's episode is called Neurodivergence and Anxiety. Really great topic. Over the last few years, I found out more and more about my own neurodivergence and autistic traits and my OCD. And which, you know, actually went a lot to explain a lot of my childhood in a freeing way. And I'm still in the learning process about it all. And so this is why I've invited a very special guest today. It's Sarah, also known as the Agony Auti, and she is going to come and tell us all about it, which I'm really, really excited about. Good afternoon, Sarah. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's nice to have another northern voice on here. Yeah, it's lovely. I mean, I'm really looking forward to this episode. It's going to just be like a brief introduction and a chat. Why don't you tell the listeners about yourself, Sarah? What is it that you do? What brought you to the world of explaining to people about neurodivergence?
Okay, so I was diagnosed autistic when I was 27, and I had no idea up until the age of that diagnosis of 27 that I was autistic, which meant I grew up believing I was not normal, abnormal, crazy, weird. And as you can imagine, that identity builds quite a negative mental chatter towards yourself. Mm. And when I found out I was autistic, I finally had the realization that I'm none of those nasty things that I was telling myself, that actually there is an explanation for my functionality, and it's an autistic functionality. And from there, and from my son's diagnosis as well, I just started to give advice out online, create videos, and signpost people to sources so that hopefully they would not burden themselves with those awful labels as well, and that they could actually empower themselves by learning more about what autism is and also about the concept of neurodivergency, which I had no clue about until my autism diagnosis.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I don't have an autism diagnosis, but it's been pointed out by several therapists and friends that, you know, that I have autistic traits. For me, it's I don't struggle as much with it, but it does explain it. I find it freeing that it explained a lot about my childhood and things. I explained a lot of I had lots of tics growing. I still have tics, actually. You might have seen in some videos I have facial tics and stuff. And I do a lot of bodily stimming, so I grab my fists together and scrunch my face and stuff, and I've done that ever since I was a child. For someone who's thinking, what is autism? What is that about? How do you explain it to them?
So autism is quite a difficult concept for even me as an autistic to grasp and to sit with. But how they currently clinically describe autism is that you need to have three pillars of deficit to be considered for a diagnosis.
That sounds scary.
Yes. So you're seen to be deficit within your communication, which is pillar number one. Pillar number two is socialization. Pillar number three is your emotional regulation. And those are the three triads of impairments, they call them. Now, the clinical model is always revising itself thanks to things like neuroscience and people-led experience being informed into practitioner care. But the triad of impairments does not do justice to who autistic people are. And one of the things that they miss out of that is sensory differences. Sensory differences are a huge living point for autistic people. So sensory sensitivities or undersensitivity. And when you're diagnosed autistic, they will bring in an occupational therapist now to look at the sensory profile of you to see if that fits. But to actually definitively describe to you what autism is difficult because the clinical model is always changing. And I really do believe that the triad of impairments will be revised in the next decade. But for me, I was like, wait one second. I don't have problems with socialization. I don't have problems with communication. I'm talking all the time. And they're like, yeah, but not in the right way. You are socializing, but not in the normal way. You are communicating, but not in the societal way that you're supposed to, which is taking turns, not monologuing your special interest at someone, yeah?
Yeah.
So that was a conflict because I didn't understand how I was that. I didn't understand that I was deficit. I knew I was weird and crazy because people told me on my whole life. But all of a sudden, I'm fundamentally, developmentally flawed in communication, socialization. And that's why the concept of neurodivergency is such an important one, because it meets current clinical diagnostic criteria and it tries to inject some humanity back into it, which is instead of seeing us deficit in communication, see it as a difference. See it as a different way of prioritizing communication tasks and skills. See it as a different way of being. Instead of that heavy, you're wrong, you're abnormal. Because otherwise you're jumping from the frying pan of I'm crazy into the fire of I'm abnormal. And that can be very heavy, very heavy. But also enlightening, because it does at least teach you or reflect the challenges that you had, but you may not have really realized. You know, I didn't really understand that the monologuing, that's not something you do in social peer groups. Something you can do on stage for a job, but that doesn't translate into those communication and relationship dynamics. It doesn't translate.
Yeah. So you say when we were talking about monologuing, is that kind of a common, I'll use the word trait sensitively. And I also love the about neurodivergence, by the way. It's a great word. Neurodivergence versus neurotypical. It's just a different type of way of thinking, way of being.
Well, that's it. With neurodivergency, the reason it's so beautiful to meet the, oh, I'm crazy, I'm weird, is that neurodiversity is the concept that there is no such thing as normal. There is no one normal brain. We have normal in terms of how cultures ideologize normal, how they envision what normal is always changing from culture, time, space to space. But when it comes to our biology, we don't have one prototype of brain that we can categorically say that's normal.
Yeah, and even if you look at, like, you know, the geniuses of history, like names that come to my head, like Isaac Newton or Alan Turing, you know, people who were, you know, there were lots of signs to point towards neurodivergence and potentially autism. You know, it's like, you know, they're the cornerstones of a lot of humanity, you know, and it's you know, to call that kind of mind, you know, different in a negative way would just be irrational in itself, wouldn't it? Yeah,
that's it. It's like Einstein would often have to theorize a lot of the things that he was conceptualizing space in his head, so he'd have to go through a form of disassociation to do what he described as mind experiments. He could run an experiment through his mind through using the visual imagination. Neuroscientifically, it just means Einstein has a stronger visual cortex than neurotypical people. So even though his behavior would present as weird, quote unquote, abnormal, he's staring at a wall for 5 hours inside, cognitively, subjectively. He was accessing a wealth of information that we as a civilization have benefited from. And that's just one person. And there are so many autistics who present like good old Albert Einstein-y, who do stare at nothing. And they are in their head, in their inner world, creating thoughts, creating theories, creating ideas, running experiments, running imaginations through their head to just see how would the scenario play out. But it looks weird because they're just sat there looking at nothing. But if you know the context, if you know the inner context, I think it's exciting. And I think it's a normal part. For me, people who don't zone out are not normal. Because if you don't zone out, how do you think? So for me, it's totally normal to associate for hours.
I do the same for hours. I will sit in the room for hours. And I did it as a kid as well. And people used to be like, teachers would be like, is he all right?
There you go. Is he all right? Not what are you doing?
I was doing my own little mind journey. And that's how I'm getting pictures of Professor X from X-Men. I'm like, I'm going to go into my little mind place now. So we spoke about like certain traits of neurodivergence. So we've got monologuing. We've got kind of mind journeying, I'm paraphrasing here. We've got, and we also spoke about sensitivity. You know, talk a bit about more about sensitivity. What kind of autistic neurodivergent people, what might they be sensitive to?
So in terms of sensory processing, it's things like lights. Mm-hmm. So light sensitivity, noise sensitivity, sensitivity to touch. And what I mean by that is our nervous systems, which are dominated by the brain, are hypersensitive or hyposensitive. So we are too sensitive to things or not sensitive enough. And it is, I think, a product of being in anxiety. When you're anxious, when you're in a hyper-aroused state, a lot of senses become intolerable or become painful almost when you're in that heightened state. So we can swing from those. But because of those sensitivities and the way that autistic people try to manage those sensitivities, we can come across with some of our behaviors that can be quote unquote concerning. So avoidance, withdrawal. So avoidance and withdrawal are basically a freeze response. We're trying to avoid the situation instead of working through it because we can't. It's too painful. We don't know how to navigate it. But a lot of autistic people have been talking about ways that they can soothe their regulated, their nervous system, ways that they can soothe their nervous system to try and get it into a more regulated state. And a lot of occupational therapists do wonderful work with this. They really are brilliant occupational therapists when it comes to this. Because learning about my sensory system, learning when to identify when I was becoming panicked, when I was becoming overloaded from sound or from conversation or from information was so important. Because I learned we have sensory overload, we have environmental overload, and we have informational overload. So it's just, we need time and space to process what is happening and what is coming in into the senses. And when people get a bit confused about, well, why are we so hypersensitive and why do sensitivities impact our life so much? It's because the sensory system is our navigator. It's our eyes, our ears, our touch. It's the thing that feeds us to know if this environment is safe or not. And a hypersensitive system can rarely feed back that we're safe because we're seeing the sense as a threat. So I do understand why a lot of autistic people end up having panic attacks, meltdowns, overloads, and it does often come from a neglected sensory profile. And by neglected, I mean they've not been taught they even have one. They've not been taught how to manage it. and they've not been taught that for autistics, this is normal.
Mm.
And stimming, therefore, is normal.
Can you explain a bit more about stimming as well? And before we go on to that as well, people listening here, and a lot of people listen to this podcast struggle with anxiety disorders. Mm. And there'll be a lot of similarities between the oversensitivity of, say, in the middle of being an anxiety disorder and being autistic. And some will be both listening to this or know people or have children or whatever. What I'd say is, you know, as we're explaining this, don't just jump to the conclusion that, okay, that sounds similar to my anxiety disorder. Am I autistic? Well, that's something that you can reflect on, yeah. But we're going to go through the different traits of kind of what it is to be neurodivergent, autistic. And you mentioned stimming there. So what is stimming? Because I only found out about stimming properly about a year ago, and I'm 33. So what is stimming?
So stim, the word is a short word for stimulation,
mm-hmm.
stimulation
mm-hmm.
or stimulant. And the idea is that through our senses, we seek stimulation. Now, to soothe a sensory profile, to look after it, to nurture it, a lot of autistics will feed their sensory profile through the act of stimming,
mm-hmm.
through the act of a repetitive, fixated, focused stimulation. And I'll give you some examples of them. So one I've done since I was 8 is, unfortunately, I chewed the skin around my hands. And I've got extensive scarring.
I've done that. All around I've got fingers. Scars on my knuckles.
Yeah,
ever since I was a kid.
That's it. Dermatillomania, my love.
I've learned something live on the podcast. Yeah, my knuckles look like they're just, the skin on them is destroyed. They're like a lizard skin. Yeah, yeah.
Can you see?
Yeah.
So this is a innate, instinctive stim. No one taught you how to do this.
No.
Gosh, no one. And I think that is amazing, considering, I know it's self-harming, however, you have managed as a child to soothe yourself without anyone teaching you. And I think that's brilliant. But the challenge for autistics is...
What a lovely, compassionate reframe, by the way. I always have people like, why are you chewing your hands? I don't know. Why is your face like that?
Because you've learned how to cope and you've learned how to self-soothe the best that you can in the environment that you were given. And our challenge is learning to displace that energy that's focused on the hands. So it's an oral stim. We're getting oral gratification here for the chewing.
Yeah.
Our job is to displace that over time. And I've learned that my dermatillomania, the skin picking stim, it will never go away. It's hardwired.
Mm.
It's hardwired now. It's just here. I do it unconsciously. I did it yesterday to the point I'm bleeding. However, as an adult, and as becoming more aware about myself, I'm able to displace it into something like crochet. So I've got a crochet hook and some wool in my hand. So my hands are busy physically doing something else. Or I can displace it through exercise. So I love to roller skate, which is spinning around in circles.
Saw you on social media, messing about on your roller skates.
I was
very jealous of your core strength and sense of balance.
Thank you. A lot of sensory play to get to that point. Yeah. A lot of sensory play. But also stim gadgets are really good for adults as well. So sometimes like a fidget ring or a squishy, you get like a squishy in your hand,
mm-hmm.
something to kind of mimic that skin picking. And it's difficult because a lot of the sensory toys don't ever give you that oral gratification that you get from the skin picking. But one thing that I would recommend is putting glue on your hand, letting it dry, and then picking that off, because that mimics the sensation of the skin. It's not... So we're not trying to get rid of
the candle wax as well. When you get poor candle, I remember that. Yeah.
That's it. So you'll pick with all of those. You sound like the kid that's probably picking labels off bottles as well and bits of glue and
I tell you what, I did that. My main stim, and it was honestly, I got called weird for it all my life until I didn't really care. I quite enjoyed it, but I've never heard anyone talk about it. I'd have a lot of excited energy. So what I would do is I would sit and I would scrunch and my chin would hit my chest, and I'd squeeze and I'd shake my hands. And what I'd imagine is football scenarios in my head, or scenarios where something's emotional, but usually it's football. And I'd just sit there and I'd like, as if like play it out in my head and shake. I mean, to the outside, they'd be like, what? You know, what the
can I just say that's so beautifully autistic, it hurts. Honestly.
Yeah, and I was like, and I had that as a kid, and I was just like, I always called it part of my obsessional part of my head, because I have got an obsessional part of my brain, and it's, or the fixation part of my brain. And when it fixates on good things, wonderful things happen. When it fixates on horrible things. That's why you get OCD. It's why a lot of neurodivergent people actually end up with OCD, because of that obsessive fixation cycle just goes round and round. And particularly with things like trichotillomania, dermatillomania, stuff like that, you can end up on those cycles. But yeah, no, that was my stim. That I was the only kid in class doing that. And I think what was nice is that I was very lucky to have a mum who just never really commented on it. She was just like, not in a cold way, just like, it doesn't matter. That,
no, she accepted.
Yeah,
you.
She just accepted it doesn't matter. And I really appreciate that as I grew up, because I interjected that unconditional acceptance. Unfortunately, though, for a lot of people, because of the stigma and taboo attached to neurodivergence about not complying or fitting in with social norms, there's lots of kids and adults that grow up, and a lot of attention's brought to it. And you must have, one, experienced this, but two, also hear a lot about it, Sarah.
I do. So this is part of the education around the stimming and trying to normalize it, is because of that stigma, because unfortunately we're called awful names for the way that we move, the way that we regulate, the way that we maybe just collecting calm. If we do that in a way that's not quote unquote normal and dignified and quiet, we are seen as a disruptor to the status quo, but as worse, an abnormality of humanity. And that's really heavy to carry when I actually...
Do you not like that title? I quite like that as a title, though.
Yeah, and we're an abnormality of humanity.
Josh Fletcher, abnormality of humanity.
I actually think we're some of the most normal people that could exist, because if we were to strip modern civilization away just for a second, these nervous systems, we've been around forever. We've always had nervous systems that have been in fight, flight, in survival states, because they needed to be. Their environment back in the caveman days required and demanded it. And there are still people that are in environments today which do demand that survival state. But unfortunately, we're punished for even doing that, for surviving. Mm. So one of the stims that I got a lot of kind of, I have to suppress it, because I still do it, but I have to hide it. So I'm a verbal stimmer. I make noises, but I hide it, and it comes out as a jaw click instead. So I click the jaw.
Really?
So anything that you repress, it will come out another way.
Really?
It will. And the verbal stims, they come around. The triggers are cats, animals, anything cute, and squishy flesh. So if I see a squishy arm, so my mum's arm is squishy. If I see her arm, I'm like, ooh, squishy! And I'm like, sorry. But then sometimes I can get into these, I don't want to say stim attacks, but I can't control them. So the cat, the cute cat's with me, and I'm just like, kitty, kitty,
yeah,
stop it, kitty! And I'm like, oh, I need to have a break from the cat, because I can't stop stimming. In response to that stimuli.
So it's an impulsive stim. So it's like an impulse as well, a bit like, again, which is very common on the neurodivergent kind of spectrum, isn't it? Where it's like, if it's neurodivergence or even things like Tourette's or obsessive compulsive disorder, it's like, you know, it's there, it has to come out. And I'm so happy you shared that as well, because there may be people listening who perhaps they've got, you know, a child or a partner who has this and all themselves, and they probably think, oh, wow, that's, you know, that's actually common. It's really common as well, isn't it? Like, it's really common.
It is. Yeah. It is. And this is the thing. The shame should not lie with us for these. Mm. If we're not hurting anyone or harming anyone, there is no shame in us going, oh, Kitty, you're cute, or oh, that's a nice arm. I know it's a bit weird, it's socially abnormal, but the shame lies with people who try to call us things like the R word. I've been called it so many times in my life by people I really love as well, when they're like, you're acting like a...
Yeah.
Yeah? So it's that ableism,
you're being a retard, a spaz, all these things.
Spastic, retard, all of it.
Yeah, which is just not kind at all.
No, but I've had people demand, why are you acting like that? Why are you acting in this way? Are you aware you look like this? And that shame is on them, because they are segregating people who are already vulnerable for their difference. And that's the shame. That shame's not on us. And I think it's beautiful and wonderful when autistics self-regulate, when they stim, when they have a little squeeze, when they do what you were doing and you enter your imaginary world because of it. Yeah. Yeah? It is beautiful. It is wonderful. It is yours, and it is only yours. Mm. And a lot of us, where our autonomy is stripped away from us. Mm. But the autonomy that I'm trying to inject back in is that your stims have a place, because they're regulating your nervous system. Mm. And our task is to continue that conversation and to educate ourselves about it, because the medical community are now playing catch up from the wealth of information that neurodivergent people are sharing about their lives. The pillar in the medical community, though, that has given us the gratitude is occupational therapy.
Oh.
Occupational therapists, I just want to say thank you. I really do. Mm. Because they looked at us with the most empathetic lens. Mm. And they came from wanting to help and to really understand us. Whereas psychiatry really did believe that our stimming was an abnormal behavior.
Mm.
It's being rewritten. One day psychiatry will include that stimming is a functional behavior. Mm. It has a function. It's chaotic, but it has a function.
Yeah, and mine never held me back, you know. And I think it's, you know, it's the brain you have is a gift, and it's unique in itself. And it would really help if you're struggling with anxiety and anxiety disorder, or you've noticed that your children are displaying traits of neurodivergence. And what's really nice is that you can take a layer of that anxiety away by actually saying, this is okay. You know, this is all right. Like that doesn't need to be worried about, you know. Just worry about the other 1,000 things that we need to worry about, but that isn't one of them. And I think
that's it. And it's so important, because the biggest killer of autistic people, unfortunately, after epilepsy, it's suicide. Mm-hmm. And for that burden of thinking you're not normal, of thinking you're so abnormal, you don't belong in this world, you don't belong, for people to have the ideation that life would be better if they just went, that was put there, and it was put there by these dominant medical narratives that have subjugated us beyond human. We are, and I think it's a disgrace I even have to say, we are human. Mm. And neurodivergency as a concept brings that in. It says OCD, you're human. ADHD, you're human. Autistic, you're human. Schizophrenic, guess what? You're freaking human. Yeah. You're all human, and you are a neurodivergent, biodiverse pool, so that our human species can collectively survive. We need different cognition. We need differences in nervous system responses. We need this diversity, or we would not survive. And I think it's terrible that autistics get lost in the other narrative, which is you're a burden, you cost society a lot, and you're a drain.
Yeah.
That's false. That's the false narrative, and we get to fight that back.
And it's hopefully, it's a narrative I believe to be changing as well, and it's a good part of social media as well. I just wanted to talk a bit more like, so we looked at some of the main traits, you know, of autism and things like that. Is there any important ones that we've kind of missed out? So, you know, there's several that we've gone through. So you've got.
There's a lot. There's loads.
Well, let's fire them off. Quick fire them off. Go on, let's go through some
more. That's it. So autism is considered a spectrum disorder. So it means that a different autistic person from one person will have a collective of needs. So I'm considered low support needs because I have the ability to verbally communicate and rabble on, whereas my son is considered low support needs because his verbal communication is different. He has to speak through echolalia, which is basically mimicking bits of language, parroting bits of language, and he creates his own collage of language that isn't accessible to everyone if you're outside of his bubble. So there are autistics who are extremely vulnerable, extremely vulnerable, but vulnerable does not equate burden.
No.
And I honestly feel like that it's our civilization's job to care and to help the most vulnerable to thrive and to access this world. And autistics may need help with accessing language. They may need picture communication boards. They may need a text-to-speech app where they can type it in and it will say it on their behalf because they physically cannot say it. And I worry that those autistics are being overlooked and overspoken. I really do. And I really hope that as we move forward with advocacy online, we do find a way to include the most vulnerable people's narratives and stories as well. But yes, there are autistics who are just in constant meltdown states, constant overload states, and they are vulnerable to being overly medicated and segregated instead of holistic therapeutic care pathways, which is what they need and to thrive.
Okay.
No one deserves to be locked in a room
no.
because their nervous system is in fight and flight for 10 years. But that is what's happening to this community. So the main things that are different is our behavior, our communication, the way we socialize, the way we communicate, the way we imagine, the way we cognate. But it is our presentation. It's how we speak, it's how we move, it's what we even talk about.
And there's and movement's a big part of it as well, isn't it? Do you know any?
So you could say to an autistic person, "How's the weather today?" or "How are you today?" and they could turn to you and go, "Well, I like this train because of this car and this and this." And it's like, what? A lot of neurotypicals at that point go, "What? I asked you a question." Instead of just joining in with their world, "Oh, trains, tell me more." That's all you need to do. Tap into their world.
Yeah.
The conversation turn-taking isn't accessible to that person. So enter their world for a bit, enter their interest, and they may want to answer the question that you asked about the weather later.
Yeah. So the communication as well is a big part of it. What are some autistic myths that you know? Is this a myth or a fact? People with autism struggle to keep eye contact.
I would say it's a fact. However, we can make eye contact. We can do it. It's just that it's quite uncomfortable. The reason it's uncomfortable is because it's quite intrusive. You're literally looking into somebody else's soul and they're looking right back into yours.
Yeah.
But also from a sensory and cognitive perspective, it's not logical for me to look into someone's eyeballs when I need to look away to think. Because I need to stay on top of what I'm speaking about. So that's when I look away from their face. And I'll be talking to them, but looking here. And they're like, "Sara, we're up here." And I'm like, "Yeah, but the concept's..."
Yeah.
"The concept is in the ether, okay? I need to
I imagine it's an intense experience anyway for a lot of people. Some people it's quite natural for them. I had to learn and train myself to keep up because I'm a therapist. But yeah, I did struggle for a long time to do it. I think I conceptualized it as, these are just two eyeballs. It's okay. They're more than this person. This is my person. Okay. Where are the time? What kind of, if someone's listening to this going, okay, I can resonate with this, or my child, maybe I've seen traits of this in my child. What can people do? What would you advise that they do?
I really recommend that people go kind Be kind, because you're going to be pulled left, right, and centre in terms of the information about autism. So do your own research, but be aware. If you're getting dragged into, we can cure you overnight, we can get rid of autism overnight, you're entering a narrative that doesn't believe that autism is okay. And you really want to be trying to build acceptance that autism is okay. It's not the disease that we've been led to believe it is. It is a neurological condition that can disable people, but a disability does not mean that we should be segregated from society, or worse, think we don't belong. So really just be kind and empathetic towards yourself, and just know that everyone's journey of autism and neurodivergency is different from the other, but you may find some comfort in community, in finding people who can relate to your experience. And there's a lot of wonderful autistic creators on Instagram and TikTok and social media in general that are building really nice breakdowns of the experience.
I like stuff like that.
So that you can see it's normal. Like, and have that.
Dare I use
identity.
The word normalize? It's nauseating. Yeah, they are. Yeah, so
they are normalizing.
Yeah, and
it.
I think it's really no, it's
because
just
it's been pathologized.
It's jarring, but yeah, they do. It's not. You know, normalize this. You know, like, but no, it's really good, and it is, and it's making it more publicly aware, and you know, and it's there, and I think it's there. Where can people find you, Sarah?
Oh, I'm on YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok. Those are my main ones. Agony Auti, yes. Auti is AUTIE, and it's short for autistic. Auti.
Thank you for joining me. I really, really learned a lot about, and even some things about myself in that episode. And thank you so much for coming on the Panic Pod. And I wish you all the best. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for tuning in today, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you enjoy the Panic Pod, I'd really appreciate a review on the streaming service that you use. This could be Apple Podcasts or Spotify or anything similar. And another friendly reminder that if you want the free newsletter every week directly from me, go sign up to the mailing list at schoolofanxiety.com or in any of the bio links on my social media platforms. And that's @anxietyjosh. Have a lovely week ahead.